Chapter 14. Lisi and Scott. Baby Love. 1. At 7:15 that evening, Lisi had a premonition. It wasn't the first of her life. She'd had at least two others. One in Bowling Green, shortly after entering the hospital where her husband had been taken after collapsing at an English department reception. And certainly she'd had one on the morning of their flight to Nashville, the morning of the shattered tooth glass. The third one came as the thunderstorms were clearing out, and a gorgeous gold light began to shine through the breaking clouds. She and Amanda were in Scott's study over the barn. Lisi was going through the papers in Scott's main desk, a.k.a. Dumbo's Big Jumbo. So far, the most interesting thing she'd found was a packet of mildly risque French postcards, with a sticky note on top reading, in Scott's scrawl, "Who sent me these things?" Sitting beside the blank-eyed computer was the shoebox with the revolver inside. The lid was still on, but Lisi had slit the tape with her fingernail. Amanda was across the way, in the alcove that held Scott's TV and component sound system. Every now and then, Amanda heard her grumbling about the haphazard way things had been shelved. Once Lisi heard her wonder aloud how Scott had ever found anything. That was when the premonition came. Lisi shut the drawer she had been investigating and sat down in the high-backed office chair. She closed her eyes and just waited, as something rolled toward her. It turned out to be a song. A mental jukebox lit up, and the nasal but undeniably jolly voice of Hank Williams began to sing. "Goodbye, Joe, we gotta go, me oh my oh. We gotta go pull the pirogue down the bio." "Lisi," Amanda called from the alcove where Scott used to sit and listen to his music or watch movies on his VCR. When he wasn't watching them in the guest room in the middle of the night, that was. And Lisi heard the voice of the professor from the Pratt College English department. In Bowling Green, this was, only 60 miles from Nashville. "Not much more than a long spit, missus." "I think it would be wise if you got here as soon as possible," Professor Meade had told her over the phone. "Your husband has taken ill, very ill indeed, I'm afraid. My Yvonne, sweetest one, me oh my oh." "Lisi!" Amanda shouted, just as bright as a new minted penny. Would anyone believe she'd been totally zonked only 8 hours ago? "Nay, madam, nay, good sir." "The spirits have done it all in one night," Lisi thought. "Yay, spirits." "Dr. Jansen feels that surgery is warranted, something called a thoracotomy." And Lisi thought, "The boys came back from Mexico. They came back to Anarene, because Anarene was home." "Which boys, pray tell?" "The black and white boys, Jeff Bridges and Timothy Bottoms. The boys from the last picture show." In that movie, it's always now, and they are always young, she thought. They are always young, and Sam the Lion is always dead. "Lisi!" She opened her eyes, and there was Big Sissa standing in the alcove doorway, her eyes as bright as her voice, and of course, in her hand, she was holding the VCR box containing the last picture show, and the feeling was, well, coming home. The feeling was coming home, me oh my oh. And why would that be? Because drinking from the pool had its little perks and privileges? Because you sometimes brought back to this world what you picked up in that world? Picked up or swallowed? Yes, yes, and yes. "Lisi, honey, are you all right?" Such warm concern, such smucking motherliness, was so foreign to Amanda's usual nature that it made Lisi feel unreal. "Fine," she said. "I was just resting my eyes." "Would it be all right if I watched some of this? I found it with the rest of Scott's tapes. Most of them look pretty junky, but I always meant to see this one and never got around to it. Maybe it'll take my mind off things." "Fine by me," Lisi said. "But I should warn you, I'm pretty sure there's a blank spot in the middle of it. It's an old tape." Amanda was studying the back of the box. "Jeff Bridges looks like such a kid." "He does, doesn't he?" Lisi said wanly. "And Ben Johnson's dead, of course." She stopped. "Maybe I better not. We might not hear your We might not hear Dooley if he comes." Lisi pushed the top off the shoebox, took out the pathfinder, and pointed it at the stairs leading down to the barn. I locked the door to the outside stairs, she said, so that's the only way up here, and I'm watching it. He could start a fire down there in the barn, Amanda said nervously. He doesn't want me cooked. What fun would that be? Also, Lisi thought, there's a place I can go. As long as my mouth tastes as sweet as it does right now, there's a place I can go, and I don't think I'd have any trouble taking you with me, Amanda. Not even 2 helpings of hamburger helper and 2 glasses of cherry Kool-Aid had taken away that lovely sweet taste in her mouth. Well, if you're sure it won't be bothering you. Do I look like I'm studying for finals? Go ahead. Amanda went back into the alcove. Sure hope this VCR still works. She sounded like a woman who had discovered a wind-up gramophone and a stack of ancient acetate records. Lisi looked at the many drawers of Dumbo's Big Jumbo, but going through them seemed like make-work now, and probably was. She had an idea that there was very little of actual interest up here. Not in the drawers, not in the filing cabinets, not hiding on the computer hard drives. Oh, maybe a little treasure for the more rabid incunks. The collectors and academics who maintained their positions in large part by examining the literary equivalent of navel lint in each other's abstruse journals. Ambitious, over-educated goofs who had lost touch with what books and reading were actually about and could be content to go on spinning straw into footnoted fool's gold for decades on end. But all the real horses were out of the barn. The Scott Landon stuff that had pleased regular readers, people stuck on airplanes between L.A. and Sydney, people stuck in hospital waiting rooms, people idling their way through long, rainy summer vacation days, taking turns between the novel of the week and the jigsaw puzzle out on the sun porch. All that stuff had been published. The Secret Pearl, published a month after his death, had been the last. No, Lisi, a voice whispered, and at first she thought it was Scott's, and then, how crazy, she thought it was the voice of old Hank. But that was crazy, because it wasn't a man's voice at all. Was that Goodma's voice, going whisper, whisper, whisper in her head? I think he wanted me to tell you something, something about a story. Not Goodma's voice, although Goodma's yellow afghan had figured in it somewhere, but Amanda's. They had been sitting together on those stone benches, looking out at the good ship Hollyhocks, which always rode at anchor but never quite set sail. Lisi had never realized how much alike their mother and her oldest sister sounded until this memory of the benches. And something about a story, your story, Lisi's story. Had Amanda actually said that? It was like a dream now, and Lisi couldn't be completely sure, but she thought yes. And the Afghan, only he called it an African, Lisi said in a low voice. He called it an African, and he called it a bool. Not a boop, not a beep, a bool. Lisi, Amanda called from the other room. Did you say something? Just talking to myself, Amanda. Means you've got money in the bank, Amanda said. And then there was only the soundtrack of the movie. Lisi seemed to remember every line of it, every scratchy snatch of music. If you left me a story, Scott, where is it? Not up here in the study, I'd bet money on it. Not in the barn either. Nothing down there but false bulls, like Ike Comes Home. But that wasn't quite true. There had been at least 2 true prizes in the barn, the silver spade and Goodma's cedar box, tucked away under the Bremen bed, with the delight square in it. Was that what Amanda had been talking about? Lisi didn't think so. There was a story in that box, but it was their story. Scott and Lisi, now we are 2. So what was her story? And where was it? And speaking of wheres, where was the Black Prince of the Incunks? Not on the answering machine at Amanda's, not on the answering machine here either. Lisi had found only 1 message on the recorder in the house. It had been from Deputy Alston. Mrs. Landon, this storm has done quite a lot of damage in town, particularly at the south end. Someone, I hope me or Dan Beckman, is going to check back on you as soon as possible. But in the meantime, I want to remind you to keep your doors locked and don't let anyone in you can't identify. That means getting them to take off their hats or push back the hoods of the slickers, even if it's pouring down cats and dogs, okay? And keep that cell phone with you at all times. Remember, in an emergency, all you have to do is hit speed dial and then the one key. The call will go right through to the sheriff's. Great, Amanda had commented. Our blood'll be still runny instead of clotted when they get here. Probably speed up their DNA tests. Lisi hadn't bothered replying. She had no intention of letting the Castle County Sheriff's Department handle Jim Dooley. As far as she was concerned, Jim Dooley might as well have cut his own throat with her OXO can opener. The light on the answering machine in her barn office had been flashing, the number one showing in the messages received window. But when Lisi hit the play button, there had been only 3 seconds of silence, one soft, indrawn breath, and a hang-up. It could have been a wrong number. People dialed wrong numbers and hung up all the time. But she knew it hadn't been. No, it had been Dooley. Lisi sat back in the office chair, ran a finger down the rubber grip of the .22, then picked it up and swung open the cylinder. It was easy enough to do, once you'd done it a couple of times. She loaded the chambers, then swung the cylinder closed again. It made a small but final click. In the other room, Amanda laughed at something in the movie. Lisi smiled a little herself. She didn't believe Scott had exactly planned all this. He didn't even plan his books, as complex as some of them were. Plotting them, he said, would take out all the fun. He claimed that for him, writing a book was like finding a brilliantly colored string in the grass and following it to see where it might lead. Sometimes the string broke and left you with nothing. But sometimes, if you were lucky, if you were brave, if you persevered, it brought you to a treasure. And the treasure was never the money you got for the book. The treasure was the book. Lisi supposed the Roger Dashmills of the world didn't believe it. And the Joseph Woodbodies thought it had to be something grander, more exalted. But Lisi had lived with him, and she believed it. Writing a book was a bull hunt. What he'd never told her, but she supposed she'd always guessed it, was that if the string didn't break, it always led back to the beach. Back to the pool where we all go down to drink, to cast our nets, to swim, and sometimes to drown. And did he know? At the end, did he know it was the end? She sat up a little straighter, tried to remember if Scott had discouraged her from coming along on his trip to Pratt, a small but well-regarded liberal arts school where he'd read from The Secret Pearl for the first and last time. He had collapsed halfway through the reception afterward. 90 minutes later, she had been in an airplane, and one of the guests at that reception, a cardiovascular surgeon dragged to Scott's reading by his wife, had been operating in an attempt to save his life, or at least preserve it long enough to get him to a bigger hospital. Did he know? Did he purposely try to keep me away because he knew it was coming? She didn't exactly believe that. But when the call came from Professor Mead, hadn't she understood that Scott had known that something was coming? If not the long boy, then this? Wasn't that why their financial affairs had been in such apple pie order, all the right papers neatly executed? Wasn't that why he had been so careful to see to Amanda's future problems? I think it would be wise if you left as soon as you give permission for the surgery, Professor Mead had said. And she had done just that, calling the air charter company they used after speaking to an anonymous voice in Bowling Green Community Hospital's main office. To the hospital functionary, she identified herself as Scott Landon's wife, Lisa, and gave a Dr. Jansen permission to carry out a thoracotomy, a word she could hardly pronounce, and all attendant procedures. With the charter company, she'd been more assured. She wanted the fastest aircraft they had available. Was the Gulfstream faster than the Lear? Fine. Make it the Gulfstream. In the entertainment alcove, in the black and white land of the last picture show, where Anarene was home, and where Jeff Bridges and Timothy Bottoms would always be boys, old Hank was singing about that brave Indian chief, Kalijah. Outside, the air had begun to redden, as it did when sunset approached in a certain mythical land once discovered by a pair of frightened boys from Pennsylvania. This all happened very suddenly, Mrs. Landon. I wish I had some answers for you, but I don't. Perhaps Dr. Jansen will. But he hadn't. Dr. Jansen had performed a thoracotomy, but that had provided no answers either. I didn't know what that was, Lisi thought, as outside the reddening sun approached the western hills. I didn't know what a thoracotomy was, didn't know what was happening. Except in spite of everything, I'd hidden away behind the purple. I did. The pilots had arranged for a limo while she was still in the air. It was after 11 when the Gulfstream landed, and after midnight when she got to that little pile of cinder blocks they called a hospital. But the day had been hot, and it was still hot. When the driver opened the door, she remembered feeling that she could reach out her hands, twist them, and wring water right out of the air. And there were dogs barking, of course. What sounded like every dog in Bowling Green barking at the moon. And oh my God, talk about your deja vu. There was one old guy buffing the hallway floor, and two old women sitting in the waiting room. Identical twins by the look of them. 80 if they were a day, and straight ahead. Two. Straight ahead of her are two elevators painted blue-gray. A sign on an easel in front of them reads, "Out of service." Lisi closes her eyes and puts a blind hand out to brace herself against the wall, for a moment quite sure she's going to faint. And why not? It seems she has traveled not just across miles, but across time as well. This isn't Bowling Green in 2004, but Nashville in 1988. Her husband has a lung problem, all right, but of the .22 caliber variety. A madman fed him a bullet, and would have fed him several more if Lisi hadn't been quick with the silver spade. She waits for someone to ask if she's all right, maybe even to take hold of her and steady her on her shaky pins. But there's only the whizz of the old janitor's floor buffer, and somewhere far away, the soft dinging of a bell that makes her think of some other bell in some other place, a bell that sometimes rings from behind the purple curtain she has carefully drawn over certain parts of her past. She opens her eyes and sees that the main desk is deserted. There's a light on behind the window marked information, so Lisi's pretty sure someone's supposed to be on duty there, but he or she has stepped away, maybe to use the john. The elderly twins in the waiting room are staring down at what appear to be identical waiting room magazines. Beyond the entrance doors, her limo idles behind its yellow running lights, like some exotic deep-sea fish. On this side of the doors, a small city hospital is dozing through the first hour of a new day, and Lisi realizes that unless she starts up a bellerin, as Dandy would say, she's on her own. The feeling this engenders isn't fear or irritation or perplexity, but rather deep sorrow. Later, flying back to Maine with her husband's encoffined mortal remains below her feet, she'll think, "That's when I knew he'd never be leaving that place alive. He'd come to the last of it. I had a premonition. And you know what? I think it was the sign in front of the elevators that did it. That smucking out-of-service sign, yeah." She can look for a hospital directory, or she can ask directions of the janitor buffing the floor, but Lisi does neither. She's sure she'll find Scott in this hospital's ICU if he's out of surgery, and she'll find the ICU on the third floor. This intuition is so strong, she almost expects to see a homely flower sack magic carpet floating at the foot of the stairs when she reaches them. A dusty square of cotton with the words, "Pillsbury's Best Flower," printed across it. There's no such thing, of course, and by the time she reaches the third floor landing, she's sweating and sticky, and her heart is pounding hard. But the door does indeed say, BGCH Intensive Care, and that sense of being in a waking dream where past and present have joined in an endless loop grows even stronger. He's in room 319, Lisi thinks. She's sure of it, even though she can see there have been a great many changes since the last time she came to her husband lying hurt in a hospital. The most obvious one is the television monitors outside each room. They show all sorts of red and green readouts. The only ones Lisi is completely sure of are pulse and blood pressure. Oh, and the names, she can read those. Colvet, John. Dumbarton, Adrian. Towson, Richard. Vandervo, Elizabeth. Lizzy Vandervo. Now there's a mouthful, she thinks. Drayton, Franklin. She's approaching 319 now, and thinks, the nurse is going to come out with Scott's tray in her hands and her back to me. I won't mean to startle her, but of course I will. She'll drop the tray. The plates and the coffee cup will be all right. They're tough old cafeteria birds. But that juice glass is going to break into a million pieces. But it's in the middle of the night instead of morning. There are no fans paddling the air overhead, and the name on the monitor above the door of room 319 is Yanez Thomas. Yet still her sense of déjà vu is enough to make her peek in and see a huge beached whale of a man, Thomas Yanez, in the single bed. Then there's a sense of awakening such as sleepwalkers may experience. She looks around with growing fright and bewilderment, thinking, what am I doing here? I'm apt to catch hell for being up here on my own. Then she thinks, thoracotomy. She thinks, as soon as you give permission for the surgery. And she can almost see the word surgery pulsing in drippy blood-red letters. And instead of leaving, she continues quickly down to the brighter light at the center of the corridor, where the nurse's station must be. A terrible thought begins to surface in her mind. What if he's already? And she shoves it away, shoves it back down. At the central station, a nurse dressed in a uniform upon which Warner Brothers cartoon characters caper crazily is making notes on a number of charts spread out before her. Another is speaking sotto voce into a tiny mic pinned to the lapel of her more traditional white rayon top, apparently reading numbers off a monitor. Behind them, a lanky redhead sprawls in a folding chair with his chin on the chest of his white dress shirt. Hanging over the back of his chair is a dark suit coat that matches his pants. His shoes are off, and so is his tie. Lisi can see the end of it peeking from one pocket of his jacket. His hands are clasped loosely in his lap. She may have had a premonition that Scott won't be leaving Bowling Green Community Hospital alive, but she doesn't have the slightest inkling that she's looking at the doctor who operated on him, prolonging his life enough so they can say goodbye after their 25 mostly good, hell, mostly fine, years together. She puts the age of the sleeping male at about 17 and thinks he might be the son of one of the ICU nurses. Pardon me, Lisi says. Both nurses jump in their chairs. This time Lisi has managed to startle two nurses instead of just one. The nurse with the little mic will have an oh on her tape. Lisi couldn't care less. My name is Lisa Landon, and I understand that my husband Scott. Mrs. Landon, yes, of course. It's the nurse with Bugs Bunny on one breast and Elmer Fudd pointing a shotgun at him from the other while Daffy Duck looks up from the valley below. Dr. Jansen has been waiting to talk to you. He administered first aid at the reception. Lisi still can't get the sense of this, perhaps in part because there was no time to look up thoracotomy in the PDR. Scott, what, he fainted? Passed out? Dr. Jansen can give you the details, I'm sure. You know he performed a parietal pleurectomy as well as a thoracotomy? Pleuro what? It seems easier to just say yes. Meanwhile, the nurse who was dictating puts out a hand and shakes the sleeping redhead. When his eyes flutter open, Lisi can see she was wrong about his age. He's probably old enough to buy a drink in a bar, but surely no one's going to tell her he was the one who cut into her husband's chest. Are they? The operation, Lisi says, with no idea which one of the trio she's speaking to. She has a clear note of desperation in her voice, doesn't like it, can do nothing about it. Was it a success? The Warner Brothers nurse hesitates for just a moment, and Lisi reads everything she fears in the eyes that suddenly slip away from hers. Then they come back, and the nurse says, "This is Dr. Jansen. He's been waiting for you." 3. After that initial blank flutter, Jansen comes around fast. Lisi thinks it must be a doctor thing, probably also a policeman and fireman thing. It was certainly never a writer thing. You couldn't even talk to him until he'd had his second cup of coffee. She realizes she's just thought of her husband in the past tense, and a wave of coldness stiffens the hair at the nape of her neck and puts goosebumps on her arms. It's followed by a sense of lightness that is both marvelous and horrible. It's as if at any moment she'll float away like a balloon with a cut string. Float away to... Hush now, little Lisi, hush about that. Some other place. The moon, maybe. Lisi has to dig her fingernails deep into her palms to remain steady on her feet. Meanwhile, Jansen is murmuring to the Warner Brothers nurse. She listens and nods. You won't forget to put that in writing later, yeah? Before the clock on the wall says 2, Jansen assures her. And you're positive this is the way you want to go? She persists, not being argumentative about whatever the subject is, Lisi thinks, just wanting to make sure she's got it all perfectly straight. I am, he tells her, then turns to Lisi and asks if she's ready to go upstairs to Alton IU. That, he says, is where her husband is. Lisi says that would be fine. Well, Jansen says with a smile that looks tired and not very genuine, I hope you've got your hiking boots on. It's the 5th floor. As they walk back to the stairs, past Yanez, Thomas, and Vandervo, Elizabeth, the Warner Brothers nurse is on the phone. Later, Lisi will understand that the murmured conversation was Jansen telling the nurse to call upstairs and have them take Scott off the ventilator. If, that is, he's awake enough to recognize his wife and hear her goodbye. Perhaps even to tell his own back to her. If God gives him one more puff of wind to sail through his vocal cords. Later, she will understand that taking him off the vent shortened his life from hours to minutes, but that Jansen thought this was a fair trade, since in his opinion, any hours gained could offer Scott Landon no hope of recovery whatsoever. Later, she will understand that they put him in the closest thing their small community hospital has to a plague unit. Later. 4. On their slow, steady walk up the hot stairwell to the 5th floor, she learns how little Jansen can tell her about what's wrong with Scott, how precious little he knows. The thoracotomy, he says, was no cure, but only to remove a buildup of fluid. The related procedure was to remove trapped air from Scott's pleural cavities. Which lung are we talking about, Dr. Jansen? She asks him. And he terrifies her by replying, both. 5. That's when he asks her how long Scott has been sick and whether he saw a doctor, before his current complaint escalated. She tells him Scott hasn't had a current complaint. Scott hasn't been sick. He's had a bit of a runny nose for the last 10 days, and he's done some coughing and sneezing, but that's pretty much the whole deal. He hasn't even been taking Allerest, although he thinks it's allergies, and she does too. She has some of the same symptoms, gets them each late spring and early summer. No deep cough? He asks as they near the 5th floor landing. No deep, dry cough like a morning smoker's cough? Sorry about the elevators, by the way. That's all right, she says, struggling not to puff and pant. He did have a cough, as I told you, but it was very light. He used to smoke, but he hasn't in years. She thinks. I guess it might have been a little heavier in the last couple of days. And he woke me once in the night. Last night? Yes, but he took a drink of water and it stopped. He's opening the door to another quiet hospital hall, and Lisi puts a hand on his arm to stop him. Listen, things like this reading he did last night? There was a time when Scott would have soldiered through half a dozen of those pups, even with a temperature of 104. He would have cooked up on the applause and mainlined it to keep going. But those days ended 5, maybe even 7 years ago. If he'd been really sick, I'm sure he would have called Professor Mead, he's head of the English department, and canceled the damn thing. Mrs. Landon, by the time we admitted him, your husband was running a fever of 106. Now she can only look at Dr. Jansen, he of the untrustworthy adolescent face, with silent horror and what is not quite disbelief. In time, however, a picture will begin to form. There's enough testimony, combined with certain memories that will not stay completely buried, to show her all she needs to see. Scott took a charter flight from Portland to Boston, then flew United from Boston to Kentucky. A stew on the United flight who got his autograph later told a reporter that Mr. Landon had been coughing almost constantly and his skin was flushed. "When I asked if he was all right," she told the reporter, "he said it was just a summer cold, he'd taken a couple of aspirin and would be fine." Frederick Borant, the grad student who met his plane, also reported the cough and said Scott had gotten him to swing into a night owl to pick up a bottle of NyQuil.
"I think I might be getting the flu," he told Borant.
Borant said he'd really been looking forward to the reading and wondered if Scott would be able to do it. Scott said,
"You might be surprised."
Borant was, and delighted. So was most of Scott's audience that night. According to the Bowling Green Daily News, he gave a reading that was little short of mesmerizing, only stopping a few times for the politest of small coughs, which seemed easily quelled by a sip of water from the glass beside him on the podium. Speaking to Lisi hours later, Jansen remained amazed by Scott's vitality. And it was his amazement, coupled with a message relayed by the head of the English department during his phone call, that caused a rift in Lisi's carefully maintained curtain of repression, at least for a while. The last thing Scott said to Mead, after the reading and just before the reception began, was,
"Call my wife, would you? Tell her she may have to fly out here. Tell her I may have eaten the wrong thing after sunset. It's kind of a joke between us."
6. Lisi blurts out her worst fear to young Dr. Jansen without even thinking about it.
"Scott is going to die of this, isn't he?"
Jansen hesitates, and all at once she can see that he may be young, but he's no kid. "I want you to see him," he says after a moment that seems very long. "And I want him to see you. He's conscious, but that may not last long. Will you come with me?" Jansen walks very fast. He stops at the nurse's station, and the male nurse on duty looks up from the journal he's been reading, Modern Geriatrics. Jansen speaks to him. The conversation is low-pitched, but the floor is very quiet, and Lisi hears the male nurse say 4 words very clearly. They terrify her. "He's waiting for her," the male nurse says. At the far end of the corridor are 2 closed doors with this message written on them in bright orange. "Alton Isolation Unit. See nurse before entering. Observe all precautions. For your sake, for their sake. Mask and gloves may be required." To the left of the door is a sink where Jansen washes his hands and instructs Lisi to do the same. On a gurney to the right are gauze masks, latex gloves in sealed packets, stretchy yellow shoe covers in a cardboard box with fits-all sizes stamped on the side, and a neat stack of surgical green gowns.
"Isolation," she says. "Oh, Jesus. You think my husband's got the smucking Andromeda strain?"
Jansen hedges.
"We think he may have some exotic pneumonia, possibly even the bird flu. But whatever it is, we haven't been able to identify it, and it's..."
He doesn't finish, doesn't seem to know how, so Lisi helps him. "It's really doing a number on him, as the saying is." "Just a mask should be enough, Mrs. Landon, unless you have cuts. I didn't notice while you were..."
"I don't think I have to worry about cuts, and I won't need a mask."
She pushes open the left-hand door before he can object. "If it was communicable, I'd already have it." Jansen follows her into the Alton IU, slipping one of the green cloth masks over his own mouth and nose. 7. There are only 4 rooms at the end of the 5th-floor hallway, and only one of the TV monitors is lit. Only one of the rooms is producing the beeping sounds of hospital machinery and the soft, steady rush of flowing oxygen. The name on the monitor beneath the dreadfully fast pulse, 178, and the dreadfully low blood pressure, 79/44, is Landon, Scott. The door stands half open.
On it is a sign that shows an orange flame shape with an X drawn across it. Below, in bright red letters, is this message: no light, no spark. She's no writer, certainly no poet, but in those words she reads all she needs to know about how things end. It is the line drawn under her marriage, the way you draw a line under numbers that need adding up. No light, no spark. Scott, who left her with his usual impudent cry of, "See you later, Lisa Gator," and a blast of Flamin' Groovies retro rock from the CD player of his old Ford, now lies looking at her from a face as pale as milk water. Only his eyes are fully alive, and they're too hot. They burn like the eyes of an owl trapped in a chimney. He's on his side. The ventilator has been pushed away from the bed, but she can see the slime of phlegm on its tube and knows, hush, little Lisey, that there are germs or microbes or both in that green crap that no one will ever be able to identify. Not even with the world's best electron microscope and every database under the eye of heaven. Hey, Lisey. There's almost nothing to that whisper. No more than a puff of wind under the door, old Dandy might have said. But she hears him and goes to him. A plastic oxygen mask hangs around his neck, hissing air. Two plastic tubes sprout from his chest, where a couple of freshly stapled incisions look like a child's drawing of a bird. The tubes jutting from his back seem almost grotesquely large in comparison to the ones in front. To Lisey's dismayed eye, they look as big as radiator hoses. They're transparent, and she can see cloudy fluid and bloody bits of tissue coursing down them to some sort of suitcase thing that stands on the bed behind him. This isn't Nashville. This is no 22 bullet. Although her heart clamors against it, one look is enough to convince her mind that Scott will be dead by the time the sun comes up. Scott, she says, going onto her knees beside the bed and taking his hot hand in her cold ones. What the smuck have you done to yourself now? Lisey. He manages to squeeze her hand a little. His breathing is a loose and screamy wheeze that she remembers all too well from the parking lot that day. She knows exactly what he will say next, and Scott doesn't disappoint. I'm so hot, Lisey. Ice. Please? She glances at his table, but there's nothing on it. She looks over her shoulder at the doctor who's brought her up here, now the masked, red-haired Avenger. Doctor, she begins, and realizes she's drawing a complete blank. I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name. Jansen, Mrs. Landon, and that's perfectly all right. Can my husband have some ice? He says he's... Yes, of course, I'll get it myself. He's gone at once. Lisey realizes he's only wanted a reason to leave them alone. Scott squeezes her hand again. Going, he says in that same barely there whisper. Sorry. Love you. Scott, no. And absurdly, the ice is coming. With what must be a tremendous effort, his breath screams louder than ever, he raises his hand and strokes her cheek with one hot finger. Lisey's tears begin to fall then. She knows what she must ask him. The panicky voice that never calls her Lisey, but always little Lisey, the secret keeper down below, clamors again that she must not, but she thrusts it aside. Every long marriage has two hearts, one light and one dark. Here again is the dark heart of theirs. She leans closer into the dying heat of him. She can smell the last, palest ghost of the foamy he shaved with yesterday morning and the tea tree he shampooed with. She leans in until her lips touch the burning cup of his ear. She whispers, "Go, Scott. Drag yourself to that smucking pool, if that's what it takes. If the doctor comes back and finds the bed empty, I'll make something up. It doesn't matter. But get to the pool and make yourself better. Do it. Do it for me, goddamn you." "Can't," he whispers, and commences a papery coughing that makes her draw back a little. She thinks it will kill him, just tear him apart. But somehow he manages to get it under control. And why? Because he means to have his say.
even here, on his deathbed, in a deserted isolation unit at 1 o'clock in the morning in a backwater Kentucky town, he means to have his say. Won't work.
Then I'll go. Just help me.
But he shakes his head, lying across the path to the pool.
It.
She knows what he's talking about at once. She glances helplessly toward one of the water glasses, where the piebald thing can sometimes be glimpsed. There, or in a mirror, or in the corner of your eye, always late at night, always when one is lost or in pain, or both. Scott's old boy. Scott's long boy.
Sleeping.
A weird noise arises from Scott's decomposing lungs. She thinks he's choking and reaches for the call bell, then observes the mordant shine in his feverish eyes and realizes he's either laughing or trying to.
Sleeping on the path. Side. High. Sky.
His eyes roll up to the ceiling, and she's sure he's trying to say that its side is as high as the sky. Scott plucks at the oxygen mask on his chest but can't lift it. She does it for him, placing it over his mouth and nose. Scott takes several deep breaths, then signals for her to take the mask off again. She does, and for a little while, perhaps as long as a minute, his voice is stronger.
Went to Booyah Moon from the airplane,
he says with a kind of wonder.
Never tried anything like that. Thought I might fall, but I came out on Sweetheart Hill, like always.
Went again from stall. Airport bathroom. Last time. Green room. Just before the reading. Still there. Old Freddy. Still right there. Christ, he even has a name for the smucking thing. Couldn't get to the pool, so I ate some berries. They're usually all right, but... He can't finish. She gives him the mask again.
It was too late, she says as he breathes. It was too late, wasn't it? You ate them after sundown.
He nods.
But it was all you could think of to do.
He nods again, motions for her to pull the mask down again.
But you were all right at the reading, she says. That Professor Mead said you were smoking great.
He's smiling. It just may be the saddest smile she's ever seen.
Do, he says. Licked it off the leaves. The last time when I went from the green room. Thought it might.
You thought it might be healing, like the pool. He says yes with his eyes. His eyes never leave her.
And that made you feel better, for a little while?
Yeah, little while. Now. He gives a sorry little shrug and turns his head aside. This time the coughing is worse, and she observes with horror that the flow into the tubes is a thicker, richer red. He gropes out and takes her hand again.
I was lost in the dark, he whispers. You found me.
Scott, no. He nods, yes.
You saw me whole. Everything.
He uses his free hand to make a weak circling gesture. Everything the same. He is smiling a little now as he looks at her.
Hang on, Scott, just hang on.
He nods as if she finally gets it.
Hang on. Wait for the wind to change. No, Scott, the ice.
It's all she can think of to say.
Wait for the ice.
He says baby. He calls her baby love. And then the only sound is the steady hiss of oxygen from the mask around his neck. Lisi puts her hands to her face. 8. And took them away, dry. She was both surprised and not surprised. Certainly she was relieved. It seemed that she might finally be finished with her grieving. She guessed she still had a lot of work to do up here in Scott's office. She and Amanda had barely made a dent.
but she thought she'd made some unexpected progress in cleaning up her own shit over these last 2 or 3 days. She touched her wounded breast and felt almost no pain at all. This is taking self-healing to a new level, she thought, and smiled. In the other room, Amanda cried indignantly to the TV.
Oh, you dumbass, leave that bitch alone. Can't you see she's no good?
Lisi cocked an ear in that direction and deduced that JC was about to wheedle Sunny into marrying her. The movie was almost over. She must have fast-forwarded through some of it, Lisi thought. But when she looked at the dark pressing against the skylight above her, she knew that wasn't so. She'd been sitting at Dumbo's Big Jumbo and reliving the past for over an hour and a half, doing a little work on herself, as the New Agers like to say. And what conclusions had she drawn? That her husband was dead, that was all. Dead and gone on. He wasn't waiting for her along the path in Booyah Moon, or sitting on one of those stone benches as she had once found him. He wasn't wrapped in one of those creepy shroud things either. Scott had left Booyah Moon behind. Like Huck, he'd lit out for the territories. And what had caused his final illness? His death certificate claimed pneumonia, and she had no problem with that. They could have put nibbled to death by ducks on it, and he'd have been just as dead. But she couldn't help wondering. Had his death been on a flower that he had picked up and smelled? Or a bug that had slipped its sipper under his skin as the sun went down red in its house of thunder? Did he get it on a quick visit to Booyah Moon a week or month before his final reading in Kentucky? Or had it been waiting for decades, ticking like a clock? It might have been in a single grain of dirt that got under one fingernail while he was digging his brother's grave. Just a single bad bug that lay asleep as the years passed, finally waking up at his computer one day when a reluctant word finally came to him and he snapped his fingers in satisfaction. Maybe. Terrible thought, but who knew? She had even brought it back herself from one of her own visits, a lethal mite in a tiny dot of pollen he had kissed from the tip of her nose. Oh shit, now she was crying. She had seen a packet of unopened Kleenex in the top left-hand drawer of the desk. She took it out, opened it, removed a couple, and began to blot her eyes with them. In the other room, she heard Timothy Bottom shout, "He was sweeping, you sons of bitches," and knew that time had taken another one of those ungainly crow hops forward. There was only one more scene in the movie. Sonny goes back to the coach's wife, his middle-aged lover. Then the credits roll. On the desk, the telephone gave a brief ting. Lisi knew what it meant as surely as she had known what Scott meant when he made that weak twirling gesture at the end of his life, the one that meant everything the same. The phone was dead, the lines either cut or torn out. Dooley was here. The Black Prince of the Inkunks had come for her.